Projects and Operations Subcommittee meeting for April 8th, 2025, 4 o'clock PM. Notification of Open Meetings Act is posted on the back, on the right-hand side. Quorum call.
Fowler?
Here.
Davidson?
Here.
Geezer?
Here.
Thompson?
Here.
And Chairman?
Here. Item number four, adoption of agenda.
So moved.
Second.
A motion and a second. Roll call.
Davidson?
Here, yes, I mean.
Geezer?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Fowler? And Chairman?
Here. Item number five, proof of publication of meeting notice and will become part of the permanent record. Item number six, USGS groundwater quality presentation, Philip Pates and Michaela Cherry.
Good afternoon, directors. I have with me Michaela Cherry from the USGS, who we have a contract with to do our groundwater quality sampling and analysis for. So they just finished getting these results done, looked over, tested, examined. Getting it through the lab was a fun thing this year, but the actual analysis, they got it kind of done in pretty well close to record time and speed. And so we did something a little bit unique this year where we added to the suite of it through some age dating sampling as well on top of the normal constituents. And so and at the end of this presentation, that's a little bit different than years past, is that we actually have some of that groundwater age dating that they got back from the initial cuts of last year's set of wells. And so hopefully the next couple years, we can keep doing some of this and get a little better understanding of what the age of some of the groundwater is, get an understanding of the recharge, the flow, and just kind of what that means in terms of what are we seeing for water quality, quantity, and have a better understanding of what we have for water in both quantity and quality in our district. And so I've addressed any of a couple of the directors that are new to the board. I don't know if you've seen this before. I'm newer as well. And so if you do have any questions about any of this water quality information or the age dating information, I am always free to have a conversation with any of the board directors, staff, or public about any of these results, because this is really fun stuff. And it's one of the more painful things to hear that somebody's not understanding something that's been presented. And I really want everybody to know, be able to go back to your constituents and say, this is what's happening, this is why. And so if anybody has any questions, please, I'm more than available to answer them anytime after the meeting when USGS is no longer available. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I don't know how well you can hear, but I'm Michaela Cherry. I'm with the U.S. Geological Survey, and so here's our groundwater quality results. So for this presentation, we'll talk a little bit about the background of the project. We'll talk about our 2024 sites that we sampled in those results. We'll talk about the age dating results and then our 2025 plan. So the USGS has been working with the Papio NRD since 1992 on this project, and this is to support the NRD's groundwater management plan. And so we sample for a number of constituents, including nitrate, atrazine, arsenic, uranium, manganese, iron, things like that, and kind of look at trends, look at the different aquifers and see, you know, are we seeing something concerning? Are we seeing things going up or down? Things like that. So the geology of eastern Nebraska is a little complex. And so as you can see, we have the bedrock kind of geology on the map. And then overlying this bedrock geology, we have a lot of glacial till. We have these layers of clay and silt, gravel, sand. And because of all of the glacial activity, it's kind of created this complex geology throughout the NRD, and so it's a little bit different compared to some of the other NRDs that are just the high plains. We have a lot of different aquifers, a lot of geology going on. And so there are five main aquifers in the NRD. The Dakota is the bedrock aquifer, so that's the green. It's easier to see it on the bedrock map. The green And then on this map, it's the dots, so that's underneath everything, all the other aquifers on this map. And so it's a sandstone, it's partially confined or confined depending on where you are. And then we have the alluvial aquifers. So we have on the right, the Missouri alluvial that follows kind of the Missouri River. On the bottom, there's the Platte, and on the left in the purple is the Elkhorn. And then we have the upland, which is everything in blue. And so this is glacial deposits that are confined or partially confined. And the upland aquifer is the one that we focused on in 2024. And it's also one of the more complex ones in the sense that it's glacial, so it's made up of clay and sand, or clay and silt and gravel. The depth to water ranges from 10 feet below the surface to 170 feet below the surface, so it's pretty variable. It's discontinuous. It doesn't really have very many well-producing wells. And due to kind of the geology and the fact that it's glacial, it's prone to a few naturally occurring contaminants. And to kind of illustrate the idea of it not being a very great aquifer, we have this AEM plot from a study we did a few years ago, and that study was looking at the Dakota, but it gives a sense of the upland as well. So the flight line for this kind of plot is that red line at the bottom of the map near Springfield, and so you can see where the upland would be. But if we look on this map, we can see the water line in blue and the top of the Dakota in that red burgundy are kind of in the same place. So everything above that would be upland, there's not really any water there that you could tap into. And there's a lot of it that's considered non-aquifer or marginal aquifer. So that's what we say when we mean the upland is kind of discontinuous. On the map, it looks like there should be a lot. It covers a large portion of the NRD, but in terms of a usable aquifer, it's patchier, if that makes sense. And so we collected 58 samples total. 30 of those samples were from either domestic wells or monitoring wells that were in the upland, and then the other 28 were from monitoring wells that are not in the upland. So those are the monitoring wells that we sample every year, regardless of what aquifer they're in. And so we looked at over 30 ions, metals, elements, nutrients, things like that, and then every single sample we screen at our lab for pesticides. And so just at our lab, it's just a yes-no hit. And if we get a hit on anything, we send it in for a more in-depth analysis at the National USGS lab. A lot of years, we don't get any hits at all. And so when that happens, we send 4 to 5 samples in randomly throughout the season for that in-depth analysis just to make sure we're not missing anything. And this year, we didn't get any hits in our lab, and we didn't get any hits on those in-depth analyses as well. So no pesticides found in the upland this year. And so here's for the nitrate. The map is showing just this past year what we sampled in the upland. Overall, the nitrate is fairly low. There are a few hot spots. And then I wanted to compare it to all of the data we've ever collected for all of the aquifers. So this is all the nitrate data we have since 1992 in all of the aquifers. And we can see that the upland, it's fairly average, it's not excessively higher or lower than any of the other aquifers. And in general, there are a handful of samples that have occurred that are above that contaminant level, but the average nitrate in all the aquifers is below that contaminant level. And then for arsenic is naturally occurring. It can be anthropogenic, but in general, it's naturally occurring contaminant. It tends to show up in alluvial aquifers just due to the geology of alluvial aquifers, and that's why we tend to see more of it in the Elkhorn, the Platte, and the Missouri. But in the upland, we didn't see any high arsenic this year, and we haven't seen any high arsenic historically. So iron it's not a contaminant in terms of health. There is a drinking water standard, and that's because when you tend to get above that, you get the rust staining on your toilets or your tubs. It starts to taste weird. And so there's a standard in terms of taste, but not in terms of health. Overall, all of the aquifers tend to be fairly high in iron, with the Missouri being extremely high in iron. Some of the wells we sample up near Sioux City are just orange. They just come out orange. And so the upland does have some high iron throughout, but it's not particularly high compared to the other aquifers. It's fairly average. Manganese is, again, a naturally occurring contaminant. It's very likely to occur in glacial aquifers like the upland is, and we do see that both in our sampling this year and historically. We do have higher manganese throughout the upland aquifer due to its geology. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a few slides. And then the last one that I wanted to focus on is uranium. Again, this would be naturally occurring uranium. We've only ever really seen it in the Elkhorn, and we've only ever really seen it in one well in the Elkhorn. It's the Venice monitoring wells, and they've gone down over the years. They used to be, the really high ones are from maybe 20 years ago, and it's decreased, and nowadays it sits right around that contaminant level, and it really just depends on if it's a wet or dry year. It tends to bounce right around the drinking level standard. But in terms of like the upland and the other aquifers, uranium's not something that we're concerned about. And so high manganese tends to occur where you have a lot of complex geology above it. So like when you have those glacial deposits of silt and of clay, it can be an indication of manganese. And particularly when we have low dissolved oxygen in our groundwater, it can indicate high manganese. And so I plotted our manganese and our dissolved oxygen, and we can see that in general, yeah, we have that high manganese where we have low dissolved oxygen, and that's generally due to the oxidation reduction chemistry that's happening in the groundwater. And then we tend to see the opposite trend with nitrate. So when we have low dissolved oxygen, we have low nitrate. And so it's kind of like a flip with the manganese. And then one thing, it's not something that's particularly concerning in the upland aquifer because we have really low uranium, but more and more studies have been coming out that show there is a correlation between increasing groundwater nitrate and increasing groundwater uranium. And so Kerry Weber at UNL has been doing a lot of work with this, and she thinks she's working on a mechanism that the nitrate in the groundwater is actually acting as a not quite a catalyst, but like it's involved in the process of the uranium that's in the geology desorbing from the solid material and becoming dissolved in the groundwater. So I wanted to look at that in case, you know, like we have uranium, we have nitrate, and so it's not a concern here, especially in the upland, because we don't really have much uranium. But you do maybe see a little bit of increase with increase, but not a very strong correlation. Okay, so now we're going to move on to our groundwater age dating portion. And so, like Philip said, we had a little bit of extra money last year that we wanted to put towards to something, I guess, a bit different or hopefully useful to the NRD. And so we wanted to do groundwater age dating of the Dakota Aquifer, because that's an aquifer that we don't know a ton about the upland aquifer, but we're also not using it a lot because there's not a lot of water. We also don't know a ton about the Dakota Aquifer, but we are using it a lot because there's a lot of water there. So we thought groundwater age dating could be useful to get a better idea of what's going on in the Dakota. And so we can use it to look at things like groundwater vulnerability. So is it prone to contamination? We can also look at recharge rates. So how quickly is the aquifer recharging, or is it depleting? And you can also use it to look at the effectiveness of groundwater management plans. So say you put a nitrate management plan into practice 30 years ago, and you want to know, like, is it working? And by knowing how old your wells are, you can know. If you're sampling a well that's 50 years old, then you have no idea if your management plan is working because it's before you put the plan in. But if you're sampling a well that's only 5 years old and it has, you know, lower nitrate, you can see, oh, like, that might be an indication that our plan is working, because we are seeing lower nitrate in those younger wells, or vice versa. And so maybe this should have been the slide before this one. So when we're talking about groundwater age, we're talking about the amount of time that's passed since, like, say, a droplet of water hit that water table and is now moving in the groundwater. So it's the amount of time that it's been in the groundwater until you've sampled it. And so in general, groundwater increases with age as it increases with depth. So it flows, you know, kind of down and along in the groundwater along these flow paths. You can kind of see like 1 year, 10 year, 50 years, kind of that idea that the longer it's been in the ground, the older it is. And then when you get to areas, like if you have streams, if a groundwater is discharging into a stream, you might have a mix of flow paths, and so you get a mix of ages. And so it's not necessarily like a cut and dry, like all the water in this bottle is exactly 50 years old. It might be more like you have a mix of 100 year and 5 year, and so the apparent age is 50, or like the average. And so we use a number of different tracers to determine groundwater age based on how old you think your groundwater is. So it's a tiny bit of a guessing game sometimes. So there's like a set of tracers that you use if you think it's less than 100 years old. There's a set of tracers that you use if you think it's more than 1,000 years old. And so for this project, we used two different tracers, SF6 and helium and tritium. And so SF6 is a contaminant that comes from the manufacturing of electronics. It gets released into the atmosphere, and so SF6 has just been accumulating in the atmosphere for the past few decades as we continue to make electronics. And so this graph is like the global mean in the atmosphere. And so when we collect a bottle of water, so say this bottle, we collected it, and it has 5 parts per trillion of SF6. If we look on our graph, we can see that in the atmosphere, the SF6 level was 5 parts per trillion in 2003. Then we know our groundwater recharged in 2003, or we know it's 22 years old. Can I do math? Yeah. And so that's kind of like a simplistic view of how SF6 works for ages. And SF6 is good for about 70, up to 70, 80 years, just based on concentrations and when we started using it in manufacturing. And then the second one we looked at is helium tritium. So tritium is a form of hydrogen that decays. It's like a radioactive decay into helium. So as it decays, the helium increases, and we look at those proportions in groundwater. So based on the tritium decay, then we back calculate an age for this. And this one is also good for like 80-ish years. You can push the bounds a tiny bit, but you don't want to push them too far. And so for this project, we collected 15 samples, 14 of them in the Dakota Aquifer, and then we have the one in orange was an upland just because it was in that same well nest. And so it's nice to get like the whole suite of well nest. And so we collected SF6 and helium tritium in all of them, just because things can go wrong if you just do one or the other. Like sometimes you might have contamination of SF6. We've had it happen where we got an SF6 that was like off the charts. So like if you tried to like back calculate an age, it would tell you that your well was negative 70 years old. So like that's probably not correct. And so contamination can happen. And so that's why we did both, to compare ages. And so these are still approximate, but this is kind of the overall ages for the wells that we sampled. They vary a lot, and they vary more than I thought they would. And so we have everything from 13, so like recharged 13 years ago, to the 20,000 one is from an old study 15 years ago that used carbon-14, so that's how I could get to a 20,000. The age tracers we used aren't that good. But I wanted to include it because it gives you a sense of the range. And so we had more wells that were older than I thought they were going to be. So that's all the ones that are pre-modern or anything that's older than 80 years to maybe 20,000. We don't know. So there's still a lot of unknown. But it shows that recharge is very inconsistent throughout the aquifer. And so we have parts of the Dakota that are most likely confined. And so that's where we're getting these older ages. So if it's confined, it's not really recharging, and so the water's kind of just sitting there, hence it's 20,000 years old. Or we have places where it's not confined, and, you know, you have a much higher recharge, so you're looking at, like, 13 years old. And so there are pluses and minuses to both of those things. So, like, a well that is 13 years old, you're getting a higher recharge, but it's also more vulnerable to contamination. Something that's 20,000 years old, probably not vulnerable to contamination, but vulnerable to overpumping. So we're still working on kind of looking at these ages, looking at past studies, seeing if we can kind of fine-tune things a little bit more as well. And so that's all I have for results. And so for this year, we're focusing on the Dakota, because we, you know, go through a different aquifer each year. So this year's the Dakota. We've sent permission letters out. I think we've had a really good response rate. We're only looking for like maybe one or two more domestic wells. We're set to start sampling in late May, early June. And then we're also working, this current funding agreement ends next year in June. And so we're currently starting to work with the NRD to make plans on the next sampling agreement and what that'll look like. And so I can't remember. I might have said this last year, and I know there's new people, so I should probably say it again. We used to be the Nebraska Water Science Center. We've since merged with Kansas, and so we're now known as the Central Plains Water Science Center. We still have our office in Lincoln. We still have all the same people in Lincoln. We just also have Kansas people, too, and a new name. So does anyone have any questions? That's all I've got.
There you go.
Any questions? All right.
Thank you, Director Conley. Yeah, I had a couple of questions on the arsenic. You were saying that, of course, naturally occurring, but is it above or below the federal drinking water standards?
So everything we sampled in the upland was below the federal drinking water sample standards. But we have had samples historically in the other aquifers that sometimes they're above, but nothing this past year was.
That's good news. And then, I think there, if I was getting it right, groundwater nitrates lead to increase in uranium. And maybe that's not really alarming for our aquifers on this side, but does that start to, as it shifts west in the state, do you know if that starts to get very concerning?
So I know that Carrie Weber at UNL has been doing studies with Upper Big Blue, and I think Upper Big Blue is the mainland, but maybe Lower Blue? Just Upper. She's been working with them a lot, kind of studying this better and kind of getting a better handle on how exactly the process works of, you know, like the increased nitrate causing increased uranium, and like what that looks like on a geochemical scale. I don't know anything that specifically that NRDs are doing, but I do know it's something that other NRDs are looking at.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
So we've got increased levels a lot of places in the manganese. What happens to that then, that information? Because manganese affects neurodevelopment even more than nitrates do.
Yeah. So at least on the USGS level, we sample a lot of domestic wells, so a lot of people's, like, just house wells. And so when we get the results back, we send out letters with all of the information. So, like, if we sampled someone, they had a well and it had high manganese, we send them back that information so they know exactly what's in their well and also what the drinking water standard is. And then from there, they can decide if they want to put in, like, a treatment or an RO or something. Like, it's on them since it's their well. But we try to give them as much information to make those decisions.
And manganese can only be filtered out with RO, like nitrates, or is there any other filtration?
I think it's just RO.
Okay.
So mud utilities, they do encounter some high manganese. They treat for some of that, and they look for that in some of their samples as well. And so they do have commercial style systems where they, you know, oxygenate that and pull some of those constituents out of the water system before it goes out into the mud system. But for like a homeowner, small private well, generally RO is the only real kind of economical way to do that I'm aware of.
Any other questions?
Sorry, I had one more.
Did you finish?
I'm finished.
Oh, sorry. Thank you, Director Conley. It was about the information. This information is readily available to the public. Wanted to make sure, assure the public, because there was a report earlier about a governmental body in Nebraska. It seemed like they were burying information about nitrates, but in this case, we
all of our data has to be public. It's like one of the things about the USGS is everything we collect is public. So we send things out individually to well owners, but like we also make all of, I should have put a slide with our websites, but all of our data is also online.
Any other questions?
I'm not trying to nitpick, but can you go back to the original, where you showed the difference, you have the Elkhorn and then the Platt and, okay. Right there. Let's say out Valley, you have that in the Elkhorn. Now, how can that be when we have water from the Sherrod going underground through Valley to Waterloo or to the Elkhorn at Waterloo? But yet, I'm just kind of confused why that shows as Elkhorn rather than Platt.
Yeah, so with the alluvial aquifers, there is, you could make the distinction that the Elkhorn and the Platt alluvial are the same aquifer. Like they're well connected. And so like we do have them separated out here, but like they're both alluvial aquifers. They both act very similarly. So you could make the argument that like they are an aquifer. You could also make the argument, like you could break up the upland more, you could spread it out. And so it's a little bit dependent on the geology and a little bit dependent on location, but especially like the Elkhorn Platt area.
Okay.
You could draw that line slightly differently if you wanted.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Question. So your data is public for the private wells as well as your, okay.
Yep, and the landowners know that. We tell them when they sample. So. Yeah, everyone who has their well sampled, it's voluntary. If they want it, you don't have to agree.
Thank you very much. I guess that's all the questions. Thanks for the presentation.
Thank you.
Item number 7, joint funding agreements for water quality monitoring. Amanda.
Good afternoon. Thank you to Philip and Michaela for that great presentation on groundwater quality. This is another water quality agreement that is for your consideration this afternoon, a couple of them actually. These are actually surface water quality monitoring agreements. So the PAPIO has been a part of the Lower Platte Corridor Alliance for quite a while, and these agreements have been in place since 2007. So we have a couple of different agreements. The first one, and I should mention Lower Platte Corridor Alliance is, the administering agent is Lower Platte South NRD. So these agreements are with the Lower Platte South NRD, but they are for USGS water quality monitoring, and it's real-time monitoring. First one's three locations. It is the Platte River at Louisville, Salt Creek at Ashland, and then the Elkhorn River at Waterloo. And this is just funded between the Lower Platte South NRD, the PAPIO, and the USGS. And those three gauges provide real-time, about every 15-minute, water quality information that is available to the public USGS website. So this is data that we think is really beneficial. Just there's a lot of things going on in the Lower Platte, new development happening, and it's been important, a lot of recreation. There's a lot of number of reasons why the group has decided and why Lower Platte South and the PAPIO have wanted to continue this. But we think it's very beneficial to have that water quality data, especially as South Sarpy develops. We can see anything that's happening. Also, this is the same data that goes into the trend analysis that the board approved maybe last year, so that we can see, you know, just any trends and things, and especially important, again, as South Sarpy develops and all the data centers and things move that way, we have some background information. So the first one is for those three gauges, and that's just between the three partners, Lower Platte South NRD, us, and the USGS. And we have had this as a 3-year contract, but we have moved this to a 5-year contract. Just, I think that maybe one of the partners was having a hard time with longer contracts, but this is beneficial for us. We can kind of get a 5-year cost put together. So it's broken out in the agreement. I won't read them all, but it's by fiscal year, and it's between $40,000 and $50,000 contribution each year from the PAPIO. And that's different based on what USGS can contribute, and then the Lower Platte South and the Papio split the rest. So that's the first one, and I think we have to vote on these agreements individually because they are separate agreements. The second one, same thing, real-time water quality data, but it is for the LaShera gauge on the Platte, and we have a couple extra partners there, so it's a little less money. City of Lincoln Water and MUD both contribute, and the Lower Platte North NRD, they all contribute to that gauge as well because that one impacts them, and it's upstream of MUD and Lincoln Water, so they were willing to participate in that water quality data. So the second agreement, the Papio's contribution is between 8,000 and about 5,000 per year. They're up on the board. I won't read them, but also a five-year contract. So if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are we approving these separately?
Yeah, we need to do A first.
There's two agreements.
Oh, okay.
We need a motion and a second for A.
We can have a motion on.
I so move.
Second.
Anyone from the public wish to speak to that item? Directors?
Thank you, Director Conley. Will these real-time monitoring stations be able to pick up any spikes in, say, nitrate?
Yeah, so they read temperature, nitrate. I'm sure I'll forget one, so you guys jump in if you want to. Temperature, nitrate, turbidity, which is a big one. That's kind of tied to the E. coli, which is for recreation important. Dissolved oxygen. Those are the types of parameters that it reads.
Okay, and I really would like to recommend this. Just a quick story, when I was on the NDEQ 20 years ago, maybe a little, about 20 years ago, and what would happen in certain bodies of water streams in Nebraska, it would happen like clockwork on a Friday, on a three-day weekend, and usually a federal holidays on a Monday, all of a sudden somebody would, you know, dump manure out of their hog, you know, hog manure holding area, and it would be a spike. You'd get a fish kill, and then, but the plume would waft downstream, and by the time someone would find out about it and then get a hold of inspectors in Lincoln, and then they're dispatched on a Tuesday and they get to wherever by Wednesday, and they try to say they could never tell who was exactly doing it. And it, after a couple of years of that, it took this high school class from some small town Nebraska with their little beakers, and they were very diplomatic not to say exactly who was doing it, but these type of real-time monitoring stations, I think they're a real good deterrent on some of these things, and I, you know, especially in our jurisdiction. So,
any other comments? Roll call.
Keiser?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
Davidson?
Yes.
And Chairman?
Aye. We need a motion for B for the next one.
Second.
Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Directors? Roll call.
Thompson?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
Davidson?
Yes.
Keiser?
Yes.
And Chairman?
Aye. Eight, contractor agreement. Ian?
Yep, thank you, Director Conley, and good afternoon, everybody. So I'd like to start with just a brief background on Glacier Creek, since it's not a project that comes to the board as much nowadays, and just want to inform anyone who might not be overly familiar. So actually, if we jump to the second page on the screen, got a little map so we all know kind of where we're talking about. So Glacier Creek is located basically straight north of 144th and State Street. On this map on the board, it is outlined there in red. It was an 83-acre restoration of what was agricultural land with a pretty degraded creek system. It's now sort of a complex of wetlands, restored prairie, and enhanced stream habitat. This is a project that we completed in partnership with the University of Nebraska Omaha. All that area outlined in yellow to the west is their existing prairie preserve that they operate and maintain with their preserve staff. It's around 525 acres. And so this project for the district was the opportunity to create a stream and wetland mitigation bank. So that's why the project's called Glacier Creek Wetland and Stream Mitigation Bank. And essentially what that means for us, it's a program that we've operated for many years. We are able to create and enhance wetlands and streams. And in return for that, we're awarded credit, which we can then either use ourselves or sell to other entities to offset the unavoidable impact to wetlands or streams on other projects. This particular site is estimated to generate around 19 wetland credits and then around 37,000 stream credits. It's important to note that those credits are awarded based on establishment of desirable vegetation at the site. So we monitor every year. We're in our third year of a projected 5 years of monitoring. For the University of Nebraska Omaha, their interest in the site was the expansion of their existing preserve. They conduct educational environmental education. They do research. They offer recreation through this, so it was a great partnership opportunity. In mentioning that need to monitor and also that need to manage in order to generate the credit that we develop the site for, we also conduct management activities every year. This mostly involves controlling vegetation at the site, so mowing and herbicide application to keep control of noxious or invasive species and try to allow the desirable species there to establish. So for the first roughly year and a half, we utilized contractors, individual contractors, to go up and mow and spray when needed based on sort of intermittent monitoring. But in July of last year, in a conversation with UNO, who keeps a preserve staff on site, a full-time land manager, so they sort of keep an eye on our site for us when they're able, we came to the determination that strategy really wasn't fully addressing the need for management at the site. It's inefficient to have an individual contractor go up and try to do, you know, a large spraying job at once. They really felt like, and they're kind of the experts of this area, that we needed more frequent, sort of more aggressive management of these invasive species. Otherwise, it's difficult to tamp down. So seeing as that conversation occurred at the very beginning of our fiscal year, we had initially budgeted $35,000 for the individual contracting of mowing and spraying. But we created a proposal with UNO and an agreement that we would instead allocate that budget for them to control our site in addition to the work they're already doing at theirs. That agreement took some time to review. We didn't get it back until February of 2025. UNO was taking a look at it, their administrative staff. And so in the meantime, the UNO Preserve staff, which is led by Professor Dr. Bragg, who's an expert in this area, he always likes to say weeds don't wait, and so they didn't want to allow this to get worse while they were waiting for the go-ahead to complete this work, and they decided to complete the work and just track the expenses in the hope that they'd be able to be reimbursed on the back end. And so, as I said, we got this proposal back in February 2025. Our legal counsel reviewed, reached an agreement, and it's in its final form in front of you now. Again, the total budget's $35,000, but to date, UNO has only expended $9,679 in their management activities. This would cover additional management through July of 2025. I wouldn't anticipate that the total cost goes beyond $14,000 to $15,000 with additional spraying and mowing in the spring here. So it also was an opportunity for cost savings for the district. It was a little expensive to have contractors mobilize every time we needed to do something. But staff recommendation here would be to approve this agreement and also to make UNO eligible for the payment for what the activity that they've tracked thus far. This would run through July 2025, and then we would institute a new agreement for the next fiscal year, hopefully with a quicker turnaround here on the review now that we kind of know what we're looking at. But I'm happy to answer any questions about this project or about our wetland and stream mitigation banking program or about the contract in specific.
Thanks, Ian. We can have a motion on this item.
I'll motion. Second.
Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Directors?
Jim. Who monitors that we don't exceed that price?
I review the the activities they track. And they're very detailed, monitoring events, mowing events, amount of herbicide used, hours spent applying herbicide. Yep, and I have all that information already, the costs thus far.
Thank you.
Yep, you're welcome.
Fred?
Yes.
Just out of curiosity, you meant the bank, the stream credits and the wetland acres. Or have you sold any, committed any, where are we at with that?
Yes, we've sold, I think, around half an acre of wetland credits and maybe around 1,600 stream credits. I could get you the exact numbers. But what we have left right now is 2.62 wetland credits, and we have 5,497 stream credits. And that's of the projected 19 and 37,000 respectively. We tried to sort of maintain some, because these are just pre-credits right now. We're waiting for the full site to establish, but yes.
If you'd send me that, that'd be great.
Yep, absolutely.
That's it.
Any other questions by directors? Roll call.
Fowler?
Yes.
Davidson?
Yes.
Keizer?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
And Chairman?
Aye. Item number 9. Fiscal year 2026 cost share program. Eric Williams.
Good afternoon, everyone. Each year, the district puts out a letter that solicits applications for cost share programs that the district provides to agencies of government across our territory to help with programs that deliver on our mission. And the idea of the cost share programs is to get this done effectively, where they lead the project, we provide reimbursement toward the local agency with a project that they administer. So this is an effective way for us to support that effort without having to build the project ourselves. The letter lists several different programs that are approved by the board into the policy manual, and we receive applications for each of the programs. This year, we received applications into three of the programs, and there are recommended projects in each of those programs to be approved now, which would mean they would be included into the preliminary draft of the budget for upcoming FY 2026. The first program is the Urban Drainage Way Program. In the memo, we do highlight that the Urban Conservation Assistance Program and the Stream Crossing Grade Control Program did not receive any applications this year. The Urban Drainage Way Program did receive applications. The first one was from the City of Omaha on Eagle Run Creek. And this project was submitted last year, but it is submitted again this year, and the cost share is requested for the portion of the project that is public infrastructure, that is the responsibility of the City of Omaha, and does not include the portion of the stream that is on the private property of the golf course. So it is a limited portion of the overall project. And so the recommendation is to approve the cost share for the City of Omaha's responsibility, essentially part of the outlet structure on the culvert under the road on the west side of the golf course. Secondly, the City of Papillion on Matthias and Delmar Creek, east of 84th, running toward the Central Park in downtown Papillion. This project was also submitted last year. It's a good project. It helps to stabilize the creek, protect public infrastructure and private property. And then last year, South Sioux City submitted a project, drainage improvements leading into Crystal Cove. And this project is for the first time all the way up to level one, which is a 75% cost share, meaning that it has met higher thresholds for environmental sensitivity and stream rehabilitation and stream water quality and habitat improvement. So we were glad to receive this application from South Sioux City for their project. This is a new application this year. The first two projects were recommended last year, but at the time we did not anticipate that either Omaha or Papillion would be able to deliver that project in our fiscal 2025, and so the board asked that we not include those in the budget. At this time, we do believe that both of these projects will be able to be delivered and reimbursement requests submitted in our upcoming fiscal 2026, which is why the same projects are recommended for approval this year. So the recommendation is the three projects with a total of $881,883. And generally, we have an individual motion for each of the different programs.
So are we approving these individually?
The entire set of projects for the Urban Drainage Way Program is the recommended motion.
We can approve Urban Drainage Way Program for those that are listed in there.
Okay. We can have a motion.
I will move for a staff recommendation.
Second.
Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Directors?
Thank you for clarifying that. Eagle Run You don't happen to have a map of where this project is?
I do. It's on, maybe about page 10. It is in there, so on, there you go. Oh, good find, Bill, thank you. So there's 144th Street on the west. The outlet structure from 144th Street into the section of the creek that runs into the golf course is the portion that's covered by the cost share. Then there's additional stabilization work through the creek, down through the golf course. And actually, the district did participate in stabilization there about 20 years ago. And that's still effective, but additional work is needed. So just the outlet portion of the culvert from the stream flows from the west under 144th and then to the east down the stream into the golf course.
It's Eagle Run, not Champions Run.
That's right, Eagle Run.
And that's still private course, though.
It is, but the culvert at 144th is maintained by the city as part of the to keep the road stable, so that's why they're applying for only that portion.
Is this amount for, and I noticed in one of our applications, which is Embrace, I couldn't remember which one, they're proud of designing this. So that's already been designed. Is this for reimbursement or future construction costs?
Future construction work. Last year when they had submitted it, they were anticipating going into design. So at this point, I think they have a design, and I have to look back at the timeline here, but I think they have a design ready to go toward bidding.
Ambrose.
Yeah, let's see. Project is planned for advertising in May of 2025. So it has not yet been bid or constructed.
So that $2 million is the estimated construction?
That's the entirety of the project, yes. And so the, their total, yes.
Okay, they've already covered the design part. The city.
Let's see, the reimbursement requested, I think does include, well, you know, I'd have to look back at that a little bit more to make sure that, I think that the reimbursement does include a portion of the design that has already been completed. I think that's how that goes. Is that your question? I thought the question was about whether or not the...
It's a good chunk of money, and I guess my concern is just reimbursing. Let's go after the Papio. You know, the city's got more money than we do. So even though this meets our requirements for the cost share, I just want some clarification on it.
So I think
how much we're sharing and what aspect of the project and what is the public good here that we supposedly receive.
Okay, so from if you flip back two pages, there is a table that does break this down, and I see it here. The design is listed as $337,000. Yep, there you go. Construction is broken out, and so the only portion that is requested for reimbursement from the district is the construction and only on the portion that is the outlet side of the culvert. So no, the design is not included in the reimbursement request.
And the public good is having a good culvert, right?
And stabilizing the public infrastructure on 144th Street.
Okay, thank you.
The erosion from upstream, or they're just what's under 144th?
So the risk is that additional erosion from the lake up the stream would undermine the outlet side of the culvert, and we've seen this in a lot of other places, so they're stabilizing at the end of the culvert.
So they're going to stabilize the creek that's inside Champions. I see the other blue lines, and I see just the stuff at 144.
Yes, I think there is additional work inside of the golf course that is not included in the reimbursement request.
That work is not included?
That's right.
Right.
That's golf course.
Yes. And then just wondering if you had a map of the Papio Mathis Del Mar Creek. I don't know if that was in there.
Yep, let me find the page for you. So Omaha was first.
Yeah,
and Embrace is also the consultant on that one. If you flip forward,
how you described it, my mind's eye had it right in the downtown area. So it was.
There you go. Okay, so on this one, the blue part at the bottom, that's 84th Street, and so the stream is flowing to the northeast. And as you go up there, there's a church in the kind of the large open area, and then it connects into, I think, east of 84th is called City Park.
Yeah.
And then Halleck Park, I believe, is to the west of 84th. So I think this is flowing up towards City Park with the lake on the south side of the West Papio Creek in downtown.
Thank you.
Yep.
Any other questions? Roll call.
Davidson?
Yes.
Keyser?
Yes.
Thompson?
No. Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
And Chairman?
Aye.
The second program is the Recreation Area Development Program. Cost share of 50%, up to $50,000. First project is Fort Calhoun, a ball field, a new restroom facility at their ball fields. Second project, I'm going to go quickly through these. If you have questions, let me know. Omaha at Churchage Park, they're putting in a new playground there. Omaha at Dahlman Park, they're putting in a new playground there as well. Papillion at Halleck Park, doing a resurfacing of the existing playground. South Sioux City at Balmer Park, and this is a new play structure in a new park that's being constructed there. And then South Sioux City at Freedom Park, and that's a new play structure in an existing park. And all of those are within the guidelines for cost share from the Recreation Area Development Program. So the recommendation is all six projects at $50,000. The cap for the program is $50,000 or 50% of the total cost, and so all of the projects cost more than $100,000, so the limit is the dollar amount according to district policy. My recommendation is for all six projects to be included in our upcoming budget.
But $300,000 total.
Yeah, that's right.
We can have a motion.
I'll move the staff recommendation.
We need a second.
Second.
Well, anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Director?
I got a question. How much do we usually spend on this program per year? Is $300,000 about the normal amount?
This is a little bit less. I think last year it was a little closer to $400,000. So in all of the programs, we're seeing less this year. And we talked with some of the applicants about bringing down some of the costs, anticipating more financial constraint this coming year than we've had in the past. So the total expenditure across the three programs that have recommended applications is lower than in the past.
Okay.
And each of the programs is lower as well.
So were there any programs that were submitted that did not make the list?
There is one trail project that submitted all three phases, and we recommended only phase three. We'll get to that in the next program, and that's because of the cost and the readiness of the other two phases of their project.
Are these recreational projects in floodplains, or is there any limit to what recreational projects can apply for funding?
Yes, the cost share letter includes a copy of the guidelines from the district policy manual, and it stipulates what types of projects are eligible. So acquisition of land or creation of recreation areas outside or construction of structures. And so the bathroom and the playground structures are within that structures portion of the policy manual. They're not necessarily in floodplains. Some of them are, but they're all in publicly accessible parks.
Any other questions? Roll call.
Peter?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
Davidson?
Yes.
And Chairman?
Aye.
The flood mitigation planning and mapping assistance program is listed, and we did not receive any applications this year for that program. The next program is the trails assistance program. And again, I'm going to move relatively quickly through the projects. Feel free to ask questions if you have them. Douglas County applied for cost share towards their trail master plan. They are anticipating additional external funding. So the request here is below the percentage cap. So it's just 10% of the total projects toward their trail master plan update. Ralston has really just kind of the one main recreation area along the creek, and they are requesting assistance for the Ralston Creek Trail. Sarpy County is requesting assistance for the Giles Road Trail. This is in the area of WP2, so it is connected to other projects that the district has worked on in the past. SID 313 in Sarpy County is the Garden Oaks Trail. This is along Beetle Creek, and it connects multiple different recreation areas. And we've talked with this SID about this project for a few years, so at this point they're ready to bring the project forward and ask for cost share to move it to construction. There are about three different parks in both Sugar Creek and Garden Oaks that would be connected by this. And then it will also, in the future, be connected to additional trails in the area. And then this is the project I mentioned before, Director Davidson. SID 405 from Douglas County is Deer Creek. And they applied, they submitted information about three different trail projects. And the recommendation is to cost share on phase three, which is in the area of Tranquility Park and the Outlet Creek from Standing Bear Recreation Area. And so at this time, we're recommending just phase three. The other two phases include bridges and more complicated structures that we don't feel are ready to move to construction within the next year. So we'll be talking with the engineer here, which is ENA, about the recommendation to cost share on this phase and then continue discussion with them about additional phases in the future. And then lastly, South Sioux City owns the facility where the Norm Waits senior YMCA is located, and they're looking to build a trail around the entire perimeter of the YMCA property, which is again owned by the city, which makes it eligible under our program guidelines as an agency of government. So the recommendation is for all six projects to be approved into the 2026 budget, the total expenditure at $793,751. And to your question, this is less than we've seen from the total request for this program in the past.
And these are all the requests, or with no other requests that were turned down?
SID 405, the Deer Creek, they requested those two other phases. Two. And we'll continue to discuss with them. ENA is more aggressive in some of their requests than some other applicants, and so they often make a big request just to see if we'll approve it, and we then do a management review of the requests. And at this time, we're not recommending all three phases, just phase three. But we anticipate working with the SID and the City of Omaha on those other projects in the future, because they are good projects. They're along the Big Papio. They're part of the Omaha Master Plan. So we do think we'll work with them on that when they are ready, and we don't think they're ready at this time.
I think I was out of order, so I will move with staff recommendation. Sorry about that.
Okay, Rick. We got a second? No, we got a second. Anyone from the public wish to speak to any of the items? Yes, Jim.
The new directors, I mean, all of these are subject to budget approval. And if we have to find money, which is going to be discussed Thursday, I guess, but conceivably, if we have to shuffle things, this could be a candidate to shuffle into a higher priority. So it's all, we're approving the application subject to, the, as it says, the budget, which we will approve in September. So just keep that in mind, too. So.
Roll call.
Thompson?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
Davidson?
Yes.
Teaser?
Yes.
And Chairman?
Aye. And that concludes my report.
And one final note, in the memo, there are two additional programs. There's no action requested, but the lake dredging program and the flood mitigation assistance program also did not receive any applications this year. Just wanted to flag that those were included in the letter that was sent out, and we did not receive any requests this year. Thank you.
Thank you.
457, Nicole. All right, it is now 458.
The gavel.
I don't need the gavel. And I will call the meeting to order of the Ad Hoc Consultant Selection Committee for the RFP for the Oak Leaf Grade Stabilization Project. I'm gonna read this. A copy of the Open Meetings Act is posted on the back wall of the meeting room. And prior to turning to the agenda for today's meeting, I would like to announce the procedure that will be used for this meeting. With respect to each agenda item, the directors will first hear staff proposals and recommendations. Then the public will be given the opportunity to speak to the item. And lastly, the directors will discuss the item and take action. And we ask that the public not interrupt the director's discussion and actions. Thank you, and may I have quorum call.
Engineering company. Hubbard?
Yes, here.
Irvin?
Here.
Thompson?
Here.
And Chairman?
Here. I need adoption of the agenda.
So move.
The ability then to do the project.
We have motion in a second. Thompson?
Let's see who that was.
I didn't see who the second was. Okay.
Yes.
Irvin?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
And Chairman?
Yes. I have proof of publication of the meeting notice in my booklet here. And now, Ian, you want to talk about the initial screening?
Yep, absolutely. So on March 14th, we advertised the request for proposals for professional services to design and permit a number of grade stabilization structures through the Oak Leaf subdivision. That's located southeast of 72nd Street and Capehart Road. Just as a reminder, this is a project that was identified by the Southern Sarpy Watersheds Partnership in their watershed management plan. And as the administrative agent, we are administering a contract for that group. and we're following our procurement process. The deadline for proposals was last Friday, April 4th at noon. We received 8 proposals. The firms which submitted are listed up on the board. I won't go through and read every single one, but the goal of tonight's meeting is to select which firms we would like to interview for this project. I reviewed each proposal in detail. I thought that every firm was very well qualified to complete this work. It's very difficult to carve it out, but I did prepare 3 recommendations for the consideration of the subcommittee, but obviously any alternative recommendations you may have, ultimately up to you. But a couple of the proposals which stood out to me in no particular order. Firstly, ENA Consulting Group. I think and a brief reason for each, but I think that the volume of work that they've completed with SIDs, ultimately this is a project that's stabilizing a stream through an SID, and the large-scale effort through Southern Sarpy will be that type of work, but led by development engineers and developers, and so I think their perspective on that could be really valuable for this project, and we can see how the process that we've developed as a partnership works by working with them. Another proposal which I thought was very impressive was from Embrace Group. The extra effort to identify all potential stakeholders and to think through long-term operation and maintenance of these structures, which will eventually be the responsibility of either the HOA or the City of Papillion, which will be the case throughout the watershed, I think was another valuable perspective. And then lastly, JO Consulting Group, really, really well put together proposal, good schedule, good details, and I think their partnership with Foley Shald and their proposal, who was the engineer on the Oakleaf development, I think offers an opportunity to leverage a lot of existing data and knowledge about the area, which could make for a more efficient project. But just to reiterate, I think that every proposal was really well put together, and any of these firms could complete the work.
Excuse me, what was the last one?
The last one that I recommended there?
Yeah.
JEO Consulting Group, I would say. But happy to answer any questions on the project, in particular on the partnership, or any discussion of the other proposals of those 3. I would turn it over to the subcommittee.
Okay. First off, do we need to take any testimony from the public?
No.
Okay. So any question from the subcommittee? Directors. Mr. Thompson.
I was amazed we got 8 responses, first of all. From the big to the small, as far as size of firms. I had one that kind of coincided. Actually, one of your pick was 4th on my list. And I zeroed in on Benish as a good qualifier. They're back practically in the backyard where this project is. They're down in Sarpy County. But then I thought there are a couple others that they keep submitting for different projects, Snyder & Associates and the Flyrider Group, they're out of Lincoln, but I can't remember. Do they have a local office?
Just Lincoln?
Yeah. Lincoln. Yeah, so my 4th one was Embrace. But it's a little bit different. And I agree, all of them. Matter of fact, you look through it and their maps and their projects, and it's like, wait a second, would they copy everyone's? Because it's very consistent throughout as far as what they can do with it. So I'll just throw that out for discussion. That's not a recommendation yet.
Any other discussion?
A couple of comments for me. As I read through GEO Consulting, they don't have any women. And so I would kind of like to see something that has a broader representation in there.
I think that Ann Williams, or
HDR. Yeah. She's HDR.
Ann's HDR.
Ann Nissen.
Okay.
And I believe she was listed in their staff pages, I remember.
Okay, maybe I missed that.
Yeah.
I would just make one other note. We generally interview 3, but we don't have, you don't have to. It's up to the board to determine how many. It's just like the level of effort to put together an interview is a lot. So we try to narrow it to 3 so we don't have so many people that have put in effort, but that's entirely up to the subcommittee.
My other comment was HDR put a focus on some green infrastructure with that.
Yep.
Is everybody going to do that, or is it just going to be rocks?
That's certainly something we could mention when we get to negotiation of the contract and working with the selected consultant, but I agree that they were the only one to outline their proposal, specifically trying to make these structures aesthetically pleasing, and I know they included a landscape architect as a member of their team, and I mean, that's another really great perspective on the project.
And not just the appearance, but also perhaps filtration, if you've got more green structures down there, mm-hmm. in flooding events or something.
Any other discussion?
Sorry. To me, this is a little bit unusual. I've been around here a long time, and generally, it seems to me that we go through and talk to the members of this committee and get their input on who they like and who and why, go down the line. And then, when we get close, then we get the input from the staff as to who they like and why. And this is you're kind of reversing it, in my estimation, and kind of like you're pushing. Well, I said enough.
Yes.
Okay. I had a couple different questions, I think, that went the other way. A couple of the things that I saw a reoccurring theme through there was questions on the 404 permitting.
Yep.
They did talk to the the timelines in between, and so I guess my ignorance is that something that they would have to bid on and then they would push for that permitting after we selected that, or is that, does the permit come after the bid or the contract would have been awarded? I guess that was the theme, one of the themes that.
Yes, so permitting would be part of the work with whoever's selected for this. So that process hasn't started yet. We would need to get a preliminary design put together.
Okay, because they did push for timelines, but then they, like, none of them really said, they said, hey, we can do this in 60 days, but it could be up to 6 months,
yeah.
6 to 9 months. So I guess I just didn't understand how that worked.
I think it's all subject to the 404 permitting approval,
mm-hmm.
is my guess.
Yes, and 404 permitting is variable. It depends on core review and.
Okay, that's kind of where I was getting to. Yeah. So there's no way for us to know what the 404 permitting would be until
correct
paperwork and all that,
yep.
is applied for.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think their estimates were just their very best estimates.
They had the government stipulated timelines. And then the other one that I would ask is since we've had a rash of overbidding and overrun contracts and stuff like that, and we've asked, and I realize that is par for the course on stuff like this. I guess one of my questions would be, in your history of these companies, have they, do we have history of them overbidding? Do they have history of overrunning and things like that? And I just think that's something we should look at.
Sure.
Those are my two concerns. I don't know if they warrant answers, yeah. or
I think it's something we can definitely look at. I'll just say that personally, the groups that I've worked with, that hasn't been an issue worth noting. But I haven't worked with everyone on this list, and so that's probably a better comprehensive question for all the staff here. And that's something we can certainly talk about when we get to interview.
Just the two places my mind went.
Yes.
Zach, just in that vein, when you select, when the board selects, or the committee selects which firms to interview, as part of that process, we're going to kind of have a pre-ad hoc meeting to educate kind of on the project, and then also the contractors, how they're performing, how they've performed in the past, and give you a little bit of, is it consistent over, addendums, things like that. So we'll give you a little bit of a scorecard.
Awesome.
That Tim McCormick thought of.
Director McCormick.
The 404 permit is a nationwide permit. How does it vary so much? It should be an automatic if you're not affecting a certain number of acres.
Yeah, so for this particular project, we're assuming it's a nationwide. We think that'll be the case. There is that existing development in the area. The light conversations we've had the course so far is that's not going to be an issue, but there is some variability in how that's going to be viewed, an additional stream project right next to that.
It might not fit under the 404.
We'll fit under the 404. We're not totally sure. We don't have 100% guarantee that it'll be a nationwide, but we're confident that it will be. So I think they build in that variability. And then even then, there might be some additional review needed, the number of structures, the impacts. I'm not a permitting expert, but I know there's...
Right, I get it. It's,
there's some variability.
It's pre-designed, so you don't know. But I was curious how that, you know, the 404 is meant to be an automatic permit. I know that things change when they get over there.
So I think it said in the, when I looked at the plans, so there's a wetlands in there. Is that right, where those two creeks come together?
I believe there have been some wetlands delineated in the area.
So on a project like this, do you get wetland credits and creek credits? Like, there are at Glacier Creek, I was just wondering.
No, we wouldn't. So for the wetland and stream mitigation banking program, those sites are specifically, they have their own development plans that are approved by the Corps separately. And also the focus of this project isn't really on enhancement of wetlands or creation of any new wetlands. That probably won't happen as a result of this project. Any of that would be a byproduct. We wouldn't be awarded credit for that, if that answers your question.
And just procedurally, too, in respect to Director Teaser's comment, we've had, it's a director's preference. Sometimes directors don't want to hear what the staff recommendations, other directors do. So I don't know when's the best time to throw it out. So, but obviously, you have the ultimate decision, and we don't want to guide that anyway, but we do provide input, and you can take it or leave it for what it's worth. So, but it ultimately, it's your decision. And you can interview all eight if you wanted to. It's totally up to you.
And I would just echo really quickly that I do truly believe that every single firm that submitted a proposal is more than qualified to do the work, and we'd be happy to do that work with them. So no preference, really.
Do we,
as far as your selection or your process, you're not using a ranking system where each of the committee members rank, and then you put the scores together to start narrowing down?
I don't think we have a process like that outlined. It's more so through discussion. Also, I think we typically don't get so many proposals.
Yeah, usually we don't get this many.
To me, I mean, over the years where you have a number like that, to be fair to each of the firms submitting, because it takes a lot of time, energy, and money for the consultants to put that together, you know, is to utilize some type of a scoring system where you've got this number of directors on the committee so that you can, lack of a better term, come up with a preferred score to start narrowing down. And I don't want to change the process here in any way, shape, or form, but I mean, that's with this many, you know, I'm sure you didn't plan on eight different, or however many you got up there,
in the past, we've done that. When there's became a logger jam, it truly is up to the chairman of the ad hoc committee to do what he wants to do. But when we get to a point where we're between two horses, then we go to that and we hash it out that way.
We've had ranking score sheets when we select the firms, like if there's three or four, and we've interviewed them, we've had rankings where you can rank them, and then when the ultimate selection occurs, but not this pre-selection, because we usually don't have this many, so it's a little bit different.
I agree with what Director Fowler said. I was going to ask each ad hoc committee member to rank their top three, and then we can kind of just go from there. So is it appropriate to do that in the public?
Oh, you have to do it.
You have to do it in the public. So if there's no more discussion, I might just go around the room and just see if we can get the top three out of each ad hoc committee member. So, discussion?
Well, yeah, discussion, just... one of the reasons we say, hey, follow the instructions, don't submit plastic sheets. I threw JEO wrong right away because I put a plastic on it. Go ahead, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Okay, so if there's no further discussion, I'm going to go around the room to each ad hoc committee member and ask for their top three. And then after that, I think we will tally them up and we'll interview the top three candidates if everybody's in agreement with that. So I will start with Director Thompson, just because
Benish, ENA, and Embrus.
Is it that the right order?
It doesn't matter. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, who's Director Hubbard?
I'd say Embrus, HDR, and Benish. But I'd also say, like, having never done this before, reading through eight of these, it kind of was overwhelming. It's a lot for somebody, this is out of their area of expertise.
You're right, it's a lot.
Okay, I will, Director Fowler.
ENA, HDR, JEO.
Okay, Director Irvine.
I would go with, I do agree with Director Hubbard's comment, a little overwhelming on the first one, but Embris, JEO, and then I'll throw a curveball in there. I thought Snyder Associates actually had a pretty good, pretty solid packet in there.
Okay, and then I was gonna go with HDR, JEO, and Benish. So if my math is right.
Shotgun blast.
Did I, Director Teaser, do we, I'll go with Director Teaser's view, your alternate, so I'm gonna leave, okay, you're gonna stay, pass?
He didn't read them.
So if my math's right, if my math is right, it looks like we had the top three were Benish, JEO, and HDR. Is that the math?
That's the math.
That's the math. And Embris was. They, yeah, they did, Embris and HDR tied, right?
You can take four.
I could interview four, if, but that's your prerogative.
That's your prerogative.
I don't think we wanna interview four.
It's Benish, Embris, HDR. That's who the two.
Who did say that again?
Benish.
Okay.
Yeah.
Benish, Embris, and HDR.
Those we had three each.
Which one of those two?
JEO had three too. Sorry, JEO had three too.
All right, I'm gonna, yeah, they, okay, so.
Four of them are three.
Four of them are three. So the.
Correct.
And if everybody gave me their votes in order, Benish was the top, is that?
I don't know if we should go into order.
Yeah, just.
Basically, the top three.
Yep.
Okay, and mine wasn't in order, it was just kind of how pamphlets were sitting in front of me.
So if we have three, I know that.
I can do four.
Take four. I'd say with that, we're gonna have to interview four, because all four had three selections, so.
I disagree.
Okay.
We, they're all qualified, but just, you're making a math game out of this. We don't need four, we need three. And if you talk to any of these folks to prepare for an interview, it's thousands of dollars, get their staff, get their dog and pony show, and we don't need the four, you know. We're trying to squeeze it into a mathematical form, you might as well flip a coin then. But nothing against HDO, I mean, and part of the analysis is what they can do in-house. Obviously, HDR can do it in-house, Benish can do it in-house. JEO, I can't remember, because I rejected theirs right away. but yeah, we've given them a lot of business anyway, but I'm leaning to just three.
Well, I will take a motion.
A motion, I'll make a motion.
I'll take a motion.
Okay, I'll move that we interview Benish, E&A, and Embris. Staff's recommendation, almost.
Okay, we have a motion to interview Benish, ENA, and Embris.
Second.
Okay, the motion dies for lack of a second. Do we have any other motions?
What are the three were, or the two that were going on? Is it between HDR and who else?
We have the one, when we went around the room, Benish had three, Embris had three, HDR had three, and JEO had three. From the ad hoc committee members. Okay. The recommendations of the staff was, and correct me if I'm wrong, was ENA, Embris, JEO with HDR right there as well.
Just those first.
Just those first three, okay. So EA, Embris, and JEO. That was a staff recommendation.
Okay.
the director's recommendation was four, was Benish, Embris, HDR, and JEO.
Could we, like, take the two that we're agreeing on perhaps between staff and that, and then?
So that the staff ones were Embris and JEO. And then, so then it would come down to E&A and HDR would be.
So the ones that are tied, maybe you just debate on those only, and the others pass on.
Everybody's, of ours, they all tie. They all have three votes.
So maybe we should do four, to be fair to everybody.
I would take a motion.
What's four?
Which four?
The ones we just listed. Sorry. Was it Benish, HDR, JEO, and Embris?
Correct, those are the correct.
Benish, Embris.
Benish.
HDR.
HDR, JEO, and who was the fourth?
Embris.
It's been a long time since we've had something this large, so doing four, I mean, this is our job.
Okay, so the motion was made to interview Benish, HDR, JEO, and Embris. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Second.
Second, okay.
All right, roll call.
Point of order.
Point of order.
Discuss the motion?
Yeah, discuss the motion, yeah.
Discuss the motion. I think four is overkill.
Which one of those four would you eliminate?
We got a motion, so you can't.
No, I mean, we're discussing it, but I'm just saying.
He can make an alternate.
You could make an alternate.
You mentioned a big project, Director Fowler. I mean, how big is this project compared to the other ones that we got?
I don't think this is a huge project. Correct me if I'm wrong.
It leads to additional. Relatively simple.
It's four structures. The principles apply to all four, that's correct.
How do you mean, that last part, the principle applied to all?
From the drawings and where these structures are proposed by these folks, it seems like there's four of these structures are going to have to build, design, or they're going to build it yet. But as far as sophistication of the project, it's not like we're building the dam, for example.
So you get four votes.
And like oversimplifying it, you know, it's a creek, you got to stabilize it.
Somebody call the question.
So flow of it.
I would just, relative to a dam, it's simpler, but I mean, in terms of complexity, it's, you know, it's the first project here in Southern Sarpy for the partnership, so there's some importance to it.
As long as you don't, if we don't have an alternative motion on the floor, then we need to vote on the, I'm sorry. Okay. Do we have an alternative motion? Okay, then we'll, then we, then. Roll call.
This is the cease debate.
Yeah.
Yes.
What's this motion?
Then we vote on the motion.
Is that question?
You're voting to end of the debate.
End of the debate, yep. Because he called the question. So this is a vote to end the debate.
Thompson?
Yes.
Fowler?
Yes.
Hubbard?
Yes.
Urban?
Yes.
And Chairman?
Yes.
Okay, now your motion.
Okay, so the original motion made by Director Fowler was to interview Benish, HDR, JEO, and Embris. And we had a second by Director Urban, right?
Second.
Okay, so now call for that vote.
Fowler?
Yes.
Hubbard?
Yes.
Urban?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
And Chairman?
Yes, and that will move to the meeting on Thursday. And Director Fowler, I'm going to be out of town, so you will be chairing that meeting. That concludes my report.
5:23.